This is SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.
This episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit is brought to you by you, the listener. We are approaching the end of another amazing year of podcasting. With SQPN, we've been able to reach people from all over the world. You're one of them, with engaging, entertaining, and sometimes inspiring programs. And for the next year, we need your help to continue. Support our mission with a gift or a monthly donation and help us to pursue what we've been doing with so much joy for so many years and to launch even more exciting new media initiatives. Go to sqpn.com/donate to find out how you can help, because we are here for you, but we're also here thanks to you.
sqpn.com presents The Secrets of the Hobbit.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. Now, where to begin?
Welcome back to a very special episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit. And I am Father Roderick, the host of this show. And I'm flying solo today because, you'll have to wait a little bit longer for us to get together with the three of us, with Dave and Inge, for our spoiler-filled, detailed review of the movie. But I wanted to record a show today because I've already seen the premiere of The Hobbit. The new Hobbit movie is finally there. And lucky for me, I live in a country where we got to see the movie a little bit in advance compared to the rest of the world. I watched the movie actually earlier today, exactly 12 minutes past midnight, so 12 minutes past 12, on the 12th of the 12th of 2012. So December 12th, 2012, 12 minutes past 12. That's when I saw the movie in this brand new movie theater here in my hometown, Amersfoort, in the Netherlands, in a beautiful setting. I mean, this is one of the most modern theaters. So they were able to show the premiere of the movie in high frame rate. So HFR 3D with great surround sound, great audio quality, just everything was perfect. And I was surrounded by fans, by Tolkien fans from the entire city and probably even from the region that came together after midnight. And this is a long movie, so we knew that we were in for, you know, basically a middle of the night experience. I think the movie would end at 3:15 or 3:20 in the middle of the night. But everybody who was there because they love Tolkien. They love The Hobbit, and they wanted to see this movie. So in a way, it's very similar to previous movies that I've seen surrounded by fans. The one that I remember most is the premiere of The Phantom Menace, the first of the Star Wars prequels, which I watched in the United States in Dallas in a theater that was filled just like yesterday or this morning with fans of the franchise. And the only difference was that there weren't too many people dressed up like elves or wizards last night. But with the Star Wars premiere, you know, plenty of stormtroopers and Darth Vaders around me. But the experience is very similar in that it is such a joy, so much fun to watch a movie that is so highly anticipated, and to have the entire theater filled with people that all react to the same jokes and laugh and cheer. And it was amazing. It was really amazing. And I was actually on the verge of not going to the premiere because, you know, it's in the middle of the night and I was like, I got to work the next day. Why bother? You know, I might as well just watch this movie the morning after the premiere. But having seen the movie, I'm so glad I did. I did stay up. And actually, I didn't get much sleep because now, today, I can bring you my first review. And this is going to be, before you stop the recording, this is going to be entirely spoiler-free. I'm going to talk about everything I saw, but I will not spoil anything. So my review is going to be about, first of all, How does it look? How did this whole high frame rate thing turn out? What about the 3D? What about the sound, the music of the movie? I'm going to talk about the story and the characters, but in general terms. So I'm going to give you a pretty detailed review, but I will not reveal you know, the plot points that I want to keep a surprise for you, because and this is one of the most amazing qualities of this movie, despite the fact that Dave and I have been podcasting about this whole Hobbit production, about the story. You've heard us for hours and hours and hours speculate about what this first movie will be about. And we thought we'd figured out almost everything, at least when it comes to the ingredients. Despite all that, this movie surprised me in a very positive way. It was a thrilling experience and so different from what I expected. And I compared it earlier with, you know, being in the kitchen while the chef is making the preparations. And so he's got all his legumes and he's got the meat and everything is cut and neatly stacked. And you can observe, you know exactly the pans that he's going to use. And you know what kind of food he's going to prepare. And then you go back into the restaurant, you sit at your table while the chef does his magic. And then he comes out of those doors with that plate, places it in front of you, and it's all prepared, cooked, and plated. And the experience is so different from the experience of watching the ingredients and the tools. So that's kind of the analogy that I want to use for this movie. We've seen all the ingredients, we talked about it at length, but then seeing everything coming together and also seeing the surprises. There were so many surprises in this movie that I wasn't aware of, and then they didn't spoil it, and I had no clue about some of the aspects of this movie. So it was a huge surprise, and it would be such a shame to spoil it for you before you've been able to see the movie. But what I want to do with this review is make you salivate a little bit. You know, it's like walking into the kitchen and then coming back, having tasted a little bit, and then saying, oh, you're going to be in for such a treat. It's going to be so amazing because this and this and that. And so that's kind of how I want to approach this review of The Unexpected Journey. I'm going to try to be very thorough in my review. And I think there are a lot of aspects of the movie that I can talk about in general terms without having to spoil anything. And it's still, I hope, important or interesting information just on the basis or on the back of all the other discussions that we've had here on the show. So be not afraid. I won't spoil it. Hopefully this will only increase your eagerness to go see this movie. And before I continue, let's start with just a TV spot just to get into the mood of the movie and to kind of like plunge ourselves into the sights and the sounds of this wonderful world of Middle Earth as it is recreated by Peter Jackson in The Unexpected Journey. So if you go to the website of thehobbit.com, you'll find all these TV trailers. Here's one of them.
Far to the east, over ranges and rivers, lies a single solitary peak. The dwarves are determined to reclaim their homeland.
I like visitors as much as the next hobbit. But I do like to know them before they come. Visiting.
Mr. Baggins?
At your service. Hmm?
I'm surrounded by dwarves. What are they doing here?
Oh, they're quite a merry gathering.
So, this is the Hobbit.
You asked me to find the 14th member of this company, and I have chosen Mr. Baggins.
Me? No, 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 no.
Hobbits can pass unseen by most if they choose, which gives us a distinct advantage.
We will seize this chance to take back Erebor!
Here, Mr. Bilbo, where are you off to?
I'm going on an adventure!
Mithrandir, why the halfling?
Why Bilbo Baggins? Perhaps it is because I'm afraid. And it gives me courage.
So this is your purpose? To enter the mountain?
What of it?
There are some who would not deem it wise.
A dark power has found a way back into the world.
Why don't we have a game of riddles?
And if it loses, what then?
Well, it loses, precious, then we eat it. If Baggins loses, we eat it whole.
Fair enough.
will take each and every one of these dwarves over the mightiest army. Loyalty. Honor. A willing heart. I can ask no more than that.
Home is now behind you. The world is ahead.
Give him the contract.
You shall not be liable for injuries, including but not limited to...
incineration.
Well, that would be a reference to Smaug the Terrible.
You'll melt the flesh off your bones in the blink of an eye.
You're right, laddie.
Nope.
Just rewatching this once makes me want to see the movie again and again and again. This is definitely a movie that I'm going to watch multiple times because it's packed with details and backstory, and it's way too much to take in one sitting. Even though it's a long movie, it's 3 hours, but I haven't been bored for one single second. Let's talk about the basics first. So as I mentioned, I watched this movie in the way that it was intended to be seen, with this brand new 48 frames per second technology, basically doubling the amount of frames per second, resulting in a very smooth, at least in theory, very smooth experience. 24 frames per second is kind of the technical minimum that they came up with around the invention of movie theaters, and it was the most affordable because, of course, you know, the more frames, the more it costs, and so nowadays with digital technology, we're no longer forced to, you know, keep it at 24 frames per second. After all, it's just a matter of memory and storage space, but people have been very reluctant to move up from 24 frames per second because our brains are now wired to make us feel that we're watching a movie if it's in 24 frames per second. Anything that is higher than that, we associate that with what we know from the frame rate of, let's say, video and home video and soap series. All that, it has a much higher frame rate. And so the fear... and the initial reactions to a bit of the test footage that was shown months ago, even before they, you know, kind of finished grading, et cetera, that material, was negative. And people were like, this is going to look like a soap series. How filmic is this going to look? Is this going to work? And then, of course, added to that, the 3D, all that, isn't it going to be too different from what we're used to as movie lovers, and as you know, since we've all seen the existing trilogy, how much of a system shock is this going to be? Well, I can reassure you, the 48 frames per second works really well. To give you an example, so I was sitting on the sixth row of about 20 rows. It's very, very big screen where I was. But I was sitting in the center, so really smack in the dead center of the screen. So it is a very, very big screen. And the first few things that they show, of course, are the trailers for other movies. And all those were projected in regular, good old-fashioned 24 frames per second. Nothing too special, wasn't even in 3D. So I was just sitting there, it's like, yeah, I wonder if I will even notice the difference. And then we have to put on our glasses, the screen darkens, and you get the Warner Brothers logo spinning around in 3D. And immediately it's like, oh, I can't believe how smooth that looks. It was such a big difference and a positive difference with the movie trailers that we saw just a few seconds before that. It was like, okay, I'm sold on this. This works. This looks gorgeous. And it was just a combination of 3D and the colors, the vibrancy of the colors, and just the fluent movement of that, just that logo. I was like, this is going to be great. And the rest of the movie did not disappoint. The only part of the movie where it took me a while to adjust to this new frame rate was specifically the beginning of the movie, the opening of the movie. Again, I will not tell you exactly what happens, but the first part of the movie, let's say, like the first few minutes are kind of separate from the rest of the story. It's something that you're going to be familiar with if you see it. But the thing is, because it's a different genre compared to the rest of the movie, the camera movements as well are very fast. There's a lot of, you know, sweeping movements, and the camera just never stops. And if you combine that with the adjustment to this 48 frames per second 3D big screen in front of you, and then there are just a ton of things that you have to take in. Everything is going very fast. The editing is very fast-paced. I was a bit taken aback. I was like, oh, I hope the movie is not going to be like this all the time, because I'm going to be nauseous. It's too much to take in. So I think it's, on the one hand, it is the adjustment. I've never seen this kind of realism on such a big screen in 3D. So that was part of it. And it was also the editing. It was just going so fast, and I was like barely holding on to my seat. It was like this, whoa, wait, what did I just see? After that, fortunately, it just calmed down. The movie just became very much like the other movies that we already know. And that's, I think, another quality that of this movie. And I'm going to say it right off the bat. This feels exactly like the Lord of the Rings movies. It has all the good things of that existing trilogy, and it improves on a number of them, and I'll get to that later on. So once the movie kind of gets back into its normal rhythm, the 48 frames per second becomes something that you forget about. Well, you don't entirely forget about it, because there are moments where it really helps you follow what's going on, especially when the camera is moving. Normally, when you do that in 24 frames per second, there can be a little bit of nausea with 3D movies. Not here, because it's such fluent movement that I think it enhances the 3D, and it helps you kind of take in what you see. It is... definitely, I think, an upgrade to what we're used to. And now that I've seen the entire movie in 48 frames per second, I'm sold. And I was like, every movie from now on should be in 48 frames per second, because it is such an improvement over the old technology. And again, you know, you need a little bit of adjusting. So don't panic if in the first few minutes of the movie you're like, oh, I'm getting nauseous. This is too much, too fast, too much 3D. Don't worry. It's gonna slow down. Don't judge the 48 frames per second on the basis of the first few minutes. Because I'm pretty sure that if I'm gonna rewatch this movie, it's going to be a different experience. Because I already know what I'm gonna get in terms of the realism of the images. Now, as to this fear that many people had, is this going to look cheap? Is it gonna look like a soap series? Not at all. Not at all. And this is something that both Peter Jackson and Ian McKellen and some other actors said when they, because they've seen a lot of the intermediate stuff in 3D and in 48 frames per second. They're like, well, you know, we showed a little bit of ungraded material, and perhaps that was a mistake in hindsight, because the colors and the overall kind of fine tuning of the image is of vital importance for the overall perception of what you see. Well, this movie is one of the most beautifully graded movies I've ever seen. Again, it's a topic that I'm going to talk about a little bit later on. At no point in the movie I was like, I'm watching TV or I'm watching cheap video. No, this is very filmic. And you're in for a treat if you are able to watch this in 48 frames per second. So the impression that this new technology gave me, both the 3D and the grading and the 48 frames per second, was like, this feels like I am looking through glass. This is so clear, so transparent. At times you want to reach out your hand and touch the grass in front of you. You know, that's kind of how real it looks. You can see, thanks to both the 48 frames per second, but also the high definition image, you can see all sorts of tiny little details. You see the wind in the trees. You see the flowers in the background moving around. You see tiny little insects, little butterflies or flies, and they're just adding to the. You know, in one of the production videos, I noticed that there was, and this is just in the background of one of the people that work on a movie in post-production. He has a reproduction of a medieval, I think it's a Flemish painting, of a religious painting. And these Flemish artists that were, you know, so famous for their miniatures. That's what they kind of how they painted with tiny little details. And I've been standing in front of a, you know, Van Eyck painting in a museum, and the closer you go, the more you discover, including like tiny little, you know, ladybugs in the grass. And that's what this movie did to me. It is so detailed, and there's so much to see in every single image that you're already looking forward to seeing it another time and to be able to focus a little bit more on all those details. But what it does is it brings this world alive. If you see the Shire, the first time you see the Shire, you're like, I want to be there. No, I am there. It is so good. And there are multiple moments in this movie where literally my jaw dropped by the sheer beauty, but also the detail of this high-resolution 48 frames per second image. I am so excited about this. Another thing that it really helps, this new technology, is actually the acting. It's substantial to the story, of course. You get very close to, you know, actors' faces. You see tiny little movements, facial movements, little twitches of the eyes or the corners of the mouth. It's something that I've never really experienced in existing movies because, you know, 24 frames per second, it's not enough to capture that amount of detail and those subtleties. With 48 frames per second, it does. And so it truly, for me, brought the quality of the acting to me as a viewer. And so, like all good technology, it does not just exist for it. It's not a goal in itself. But it is there to enhance the story, and in this case, it did, and it also enhanced the acting. So for me, that is a win for 48 frames per second. It works really well for the slower camera moves, the big scenes where you're, you know, admiring Middle Earth or, you know, aka New Zealand. It gets a bit overwhelming in frantic action scenes, and there are a couple of those scenes where there's a lot of running, a lot of fighting, and then it's just too much to take in. So I would advise you, if I'm going to watch this movie again, I will probably not sit on the sixth row. I will go a little bit further in the back of the theater because I think it'll be easier, as an experience, easier on the eyes and on the mind, because there's just so much happening and just the realism. It's a bit overwhelming, but then again, I'm thinking in 24 frames per second, this probably would be worse because it would be so stroboscopic, you know, and it would be even more frantic. So I don't know. I'll have to watch it in regular 2D and in 24 frames per second to know that for sure. But I'm thinking, you know, this is also a learning curve probably for this new technology. Overall, I think it is brilliant. It really enhances the movie. But it's probably also kind of figuring out what you can do with the audience and whatnot. And perhaps, again, it's just a matter of getting used to it. Let's go to my second point of this review, which is the 3D. How good is it? Because there are a lot of really bad 3D conversions out there. You know, I've watched the last two Harry Potter movies. You'd think a huge franchise, so they'll get this right. Well, they didn't. It's jarring 3D. Oftentimes, it's disappointing. And sometimes, it's just not even there. You're just watching a flat image, and there's hardly any depth to it. So a lot of those experiences made people very wary of 3D. You know, how does it really work? And is it something that we really need? Well, what about 3D in The Hobbit? I think it works really well in some places. It works best in the vistas, when you see Rivendell for the first time. Oh, it's so beautiful. You've never seen Rivendell this beautiful. And the 3D is an integral part of that experience. You've seen in this TV trailer, you see this moment where they're talking to each other and they're on this ledge and you see the waterfalls in the background and there's this kind of crystal table or this chunk of mountain crystal on with a flattened surface, and that's where they talk about what they're going to do next. That scene in 3D is mind-blowingly beautiful. I just wanted to freeze frame. It's like, I just got to stare at this for half an hour. Just let me be. Just forget about the movie. I just want to be here. So the 3D is amazing in those big scenes. Also, towards the end, I won't tell you what exactly it is, but the 3D there is on par with what we saw in Cameron's Avatar movie. And, by the way, it's exactly a scene that I predicted in our speculation. I was like, this is what's going to happen. This is why you want 3D at the end of the movie. Well, I was right about that. It is gorgeous. But most of the time, and I think that's actually a positive thing, most of the time you forget that it's there. And it's much more the 3D. It's not the let me poke something in your eye type of 3D, but it's 3D almost as if you're in a theater. And as I mentioned before, it's like looking through a glass and the world you see has depth. So it moves inwards and not outwards, which to me is a much more acceptable type of 3D. So I really enjoyed that. But again, I don't think that I would miss it. I mean, I appreciated it at moments during the movie, but I think I would enjoy this movie just as much in 2D. So that's good news for all of us that don't have a 3D television, or if you cannot stand 3D and you get nauseous, because, you know, some people just cannot process 3D in theaters. Don't worry, you're not missing out. You're going to have a blast. This movie works just as well in 2D as it does in 3D. I'm absolutely convinced of it. By the way, if you're one of those people that, you know, have like almost a physical problem with 3D, you can buy these polarized glasses that will actually negate the 3D effect. So you might want to look into that. Probably just a couple of bucks on the internet. So look out for that if you really are afraid that you're going to get nauseous. But I didn't get nauseous, and the 3D experience was way better than like 90% of the other movies that I've seen. There were a few moments where, and I guess this is just part of the limitations of the technology, the foreground seems to be somewhat flat compared to the background. So you'll have this blurred out background, which is CGI in some scenes. Not that you notice it, but you know that you're looking at a painting. And then the characters in the foreground seem to be almost like they're cutouts. And I don't know, I you know, they filmed this this is not post-processing 3D. They filmed it with two cameras there. So I guess it's what the eye would see as well. But it's probably because of the composition, because the background is so far away and it's a little bit blurry, that your mind tells you the foreground is flat. So there were a few moments where I was like, not convinced. But it's not... Yeah, it's just detail, and I'm very much of a 3D fan and aficionado, so perhaps I'm noticing this, but I doubt that the rest of the theater did. So where it's, again, as I mentioned, where it really wows you and pops out is the vistas of New Zealand, the helicopter shots. You know, they've been for a couple of months. They've been flying around the country trying to find the most beautiful spots of the southern island of New Zealand. Well, they did. It's breathtakingly beautiful. It actually made me long for a 3D post-conversion of the existing Lord of the Rings trilogy. I think they could totally pull it off. If they would do it at the quality level of The Phantom Menace, which is Titanic, which is also post-production 3D. Those are examples to me of really, really good post-production, post-processing of 3D. And I think that The Lord of the Rings would benefit from it. I think they could pull it off and make it look just as nice as The Hobbit. So in general, I think the 3D really worked. It does not attract attention to itself. It gives you a few moments where you're like, oh, wow. And that's good enough for me. Let's talk about the story and the characters, but let's first take a short break.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. This is wonderful.
I meant to go back. Wander the paths of Mirkwood. Visit Lake Town, see the Lonely Mountain again. But age, it seems, has finally caught up with me.
So this, of course, is a scene that we know from the existing trilogy. And we hear a slightly older Bilbo. Age is caught up with him. The big surprise to me was the way we know, and this is not a spoiler, right? We will see old Bilbo and we will see Frodo again, which is amazing. I mean, I love that. They brought back the original actors and we get to see them in this movie. I won't tell you exactly how and to which extent, but suffice it to say that it is surprisingly well done. And in general, I was amazed to see how they brought back existing actors, existing characters that we know and love. But of course, they have to be younger in this movie. And well, they pulled that off. And I still don't know how they did it. But, you know, Bilbo, Frodo, Galadriel, Saruman, Elrond. You're like, these have to be younger versions of themselves. How do they do that? If it's makeup or digital stuff. So I don't know how they did it, but it is so amazing. Really amazing. Anyway, that's nor here and there. Let's talk about the story. The big question for all true Tolkien fans, of course, is how faithful will this movie be to the book? Nothing more upsetting for a fan of Tolkien's writings, you know, to see a scene that you know and love and it's totally messed up and it's changed and they went for cheap effects. Not that I feel that Peter Jackson and the other writers did this on purpose, but it can be upsetting if a movie strays away too far from the original. And there were some changes in the Lord of the Rings movies that were very upsetting to a lot of fans. And so you've got the purists that were very wary. And so that's the question that's constantly on their mind leading up to the premiere. How close will this be to the book? An additional reason for them to fear is that the movie was announced to be split up in three movies. How can you turn a relatively short book geared towards children like The Hobbit into a three-movie epic trilogy? Can you do that without really straying off the path of you know, Tolkien's writings? Well, again, I want to reassure you, the book really feels like The Hobbit. It really feels like the way I remember The Hobbit book. It has a certain gentleness to the story. Martin Freeman, I think, is one of the contributing factors to the feel, to the fidelity of this book to the atmosphere. Fidelity of this movie to the atmosphere of the book, the way I remembered it. He's a wonderful Bilbo. He plays Bilbo in a very down to middle earth way, and his humility really grounds the movie. This is Bilbo. He's perfect. The dwarves are fantastic. They are the stars of this movie. What I loved about it is that it both stays very close to the lines in the book. So a lot of the dialogue, almost everything in the book is in the movie, but it is enhanced. It's given more depth, and especially with the dwarves, what Peter Jackson and the other writers did, and the actors, let's not forget the actors, what they managed to pull off was to take the quality of the dwarves, the story of the dwarves, that was given to us by Tolkien, and then they just add to it in a way that made me so admirative of both of what Tolkien already put in the book and then what they added. The dwarves, their interactions are believable. Sometimes they're funny, and it's really a great comedic group. But there are also very serious moments, and I didn't expect this at all. I thought that we would get kind of a caricature of the relationships that you see in the book, and I think it is because we've watched these trailers, these TV spots, and you know, you get the little jokes, and there's like, okay, but is this going to be a believable group, or are we going to get just, you know, archetypes of dwarves? Well, the dwarves are amazing. And the acting is spot on. It's so good. And you totally believe, after 5 minutes, you totally believe that these dwarves have known each other for years, that they're all different, and that somehow this group kind of fits, and it works. And it works also in relation to Martin Freeman's Bilbo. So I didn't see that coming. It was amazing what they pulled off there. The dwarfs, definitely one of the best elements of this first movie, the interactions. They are, well, in a way, they're real three-dimensional characters, which is something amazing to do with, you know, basically a children's book at the basis. And I think that Tolkien already kind of he put it there. It was there, but it needed to be expanded to really work. But it is very faithful to the overall atmosphere of the original book. The second question, of course, is, does the story arc work for the first movie? Because originally we kind of figured out that if this, and this was still when we would get two movies, right? We were like, okay, the movie has to end with the arrival in Lake Town. And then we might see, you know, the Lonely Mountain. That might be the last thing that we see. Or we might see the dragon. That was always my speculation, that the movie would end with a glimpse of the dragon. Well, I won't say anything, but I'm proud of myself. No, just kidding. So now the movie could not end with Lake Town because it would be too far ahead in the story. And so we knew that the story was going to end at a much earlier moment. And my big fear was that, is it enough? Is it enough to keep me interested? Because the meat of the story is when they arrive at Lake Town. That's where it really starts. Mirkwood. It's an important part, this whole escape on the barrel scene. I was like, if you take that out, does the story have enough meat to stand on its own? Again, let me reassure you, it has. It totally works, this first story arc. The story ends much earlier, but as a whole, at the end of the movie, you're like, wow, I really watched a story that stands on itself, that has a good arc, also an emotional arc, and I definitely feel that we're in the story now. And it's not like, oh, they took the first few chapters and they just dragged on and on and on, and it's like they're keeping all the good stuff for the second movie. No, I was like, wow, I am happy with this first story. I got what I hoped for. I got even more than I hoped for, and this is a really good way to end the first movie. And now I want to see 2 and 3 as well. But this movie, I can watch it time and again, because by itself, this part of the story works. And they had to adapt it a little bit and change the balance of these elements, because part of the final events in the story in the book are kind of small. They're not that important to the overall story, especially, you know, in the context of the entire story. But so they were at points dramatized a little bit more, but again, still in line with what's already there in the book, and I think the story benefits from it. The first movie benefits from it. So let's go a little bit more into detail about the story. There were some parts that are pretty heavy on the exposition. This is the first movie of the entire franchise, chronologically. So you need to establish first, of course, what is the context of this quest for the dragon, for the dragon's gold, for this mountain? Why do these dwarves, why are they so motivated to go to the mountain and defeat Smaug? And it's something that in the book, you kind of get a glimpse of their motivation, but in this story, and this is based on the appendices that were written later on by Tolkien, they establish that motivation in a much better way than the book does. And you need exposition for that. You need to know what the backgrounds of the dwarves is, where they come from, what happened in the past with these dwarves. And the moment you've seen that, their whole quest gets a lot more depth
than I remember from the book. And so the movie does that very well. It does give us some moments where you're like, okay, this is exposition. So now we need to have a little bit of that context and that backstory. I personally didn't mind at all. Actually, I enjoyed it because it is important information. It is exposition, but it is needed for the story. So it is not unnecessary exposition. It's not like, oh, let me give you a rundown of the entire history of Middle-earth and all these names and details that you're going to forget because they're not important to the story. Now, everything you see has a function for the rest of the development of the story and of the first movie. So I didn't mind at all that there was extensive exposition and it was very well presented. I mean, it's a joy to look at. And I was like, give me more. Look, I am waiting for the extended edition because it's, you know, it's just awesome stuff. All right. So exposition is there. Also, there are a few surprises in this movie story-wise. Elements that I kind of knew that had to be there in one of these three movies. And I think if you're going to watch this movie and if you listen and you've listened to our more recent podcasts, you will recognize some of the stuff, so it won't be a total surprise. But the way in which they introduce these new story elements was blew me away. I was like, oh, I didn't see this coming. One thing, and again, I'm not going to spoil any details, but there is a villain in this movie, and I had heard of him, but again, it's like knowing that there's going to be this ingredient, but once you see the final result and how this character is woven into the story, I was like, oh, I like this. This is an amazing villain. Really scary, very well done, and I had not seen anything of this villain, so that was a big surprise. Like, and he works very well in the context of the entire story of the first movie. It's like this part of the story needs him as a villain, and yes, it is not in a book, not in this way. They've taken a bit of liberty there, but it's based on a character that we know is part of Tolkien's world. And but if you see what they did with that and how it helps this first part of the movie and how this villain is extremely important for the story arc of one of the dwarves and also in a way of Bilbo. And once you see that at the end of the movie, how it all kind of comes together, I totally forgive them for, you know, using a bit of imagination and creative license with this part of the story, because without it, I'm not sure if this first part would have worked emotionally. But the way they do this is just brilliant, and it's very much again, this villain fits the type of characters that we know from the existing trilogy. So it's not like, oh, come on, you know, how did they come up with this? No, you're just like, oh, this could have totally been written by Tolkien himself. So the way in which they tell this story, this villain is amazing. I'd say he's better than Voldemort. And believe me, I'm a huge fan of the Harry Potter franchise and the movies. But this is way better than Voldemort and way more scarier. So anyway, excited about this villain. And it was a surprise. Now, let's talk about some other stuff. The pacing of the movie. It's, given that it's such a small part of the story, is this I will tell you my biggest fear. When I saw all the production videos and the trailers and the TV spots, I was so afraid that the part in Bag End, so Bilbo's house, would be boring. And it would be just exposition, and it seemed to just drag on. And yeah, I kind of like seeing the dwarves eat in Bilbo's house, but it's like, it was as if every single thing we saw was just dwarves goofing around. And I was afraid that that part of the movie would be kind of been there, done that. It's like, yeah, whatever, just move on with the story. Now, we spend considerable time in Bag End. We spend a lot of time in these introductionary scenes with Bilbo and the dwarfs and Gandalf. But the way that they tell this story, the way it's filmed, the pacing of that part is genius. It is so well done. And it feels totally natural. And you have to take that time to introduce these characters and to show the interaction. It serves the story and it serves the character development, both of the dwarves and of Bilbo. And so it was another moment where I was like, I did not expect this part of the movie to be this good. Again, we've seen so much of it, and once you see the final result, you're like, oh yeah, oh, wow, great, great stuff. So very, very happy with the pacing of that movie. I actually like the fact that that Peter Jackson takes his time in the beginning of this story. The story needs it. Then another thing that works really well is that at one point, the beginning of the movie, everybody's together. And then, and you know this from the book, right? The story splits up. The characters get separated. And then the balance of the movie becomes really interesting because you've got, on the one hand, a very action-packed part of the story, and its counterpoint, it's almost like a musical counterpoint, is a different, the other part of the story. And I'm trying to stay very vague, but you know what I'm talking about, right? That other part of the story works great because it takes its time. And everything that I know and love from that particular chapter, which is one of the cool... Okay, I'm going to say what it is. It's the riddle, the game of riddles. Bilbo and Gollum. It is the best scene of the movie. And again, it was something that I was not certain of. I was like, this is a long chapter. There's a lot of dialogue. How are they going to make this interesting? And so we speculated with Dave, you know, my take was like, they can't just stay in that cave all the time. It's it's like we're talking 20 minutes. And so they need flashbacks. So they're going to show us, you know, 2-3 things happening between Bilbo and Gollum, and then they're going to cut to the other, to the dwarves, et cetera. And they're just going to spice it up with flashbacks, et cetera. Not at all. This scene is like reading the book. But it is, the book comes to life, that particular chapter comes to life, and you suddenly discover the strength, the power of that scene, the quality of Tolkien's writing. There were moments where the entire audience in the theater was reacting together. And I was like, this is not Peter Jackson. This is Tolkien that they're reacting to. And the delivery and the timing of the actors, the comedic timing also sometimes of the actors, is so great. And it has such high quality that they show the audience of in this day and age, you know, we're decades after Tolkien wrote this down, and it's like an immediate transfusion of the blood and the energy of the original book, and it still works. I was blown away by that scene between Gollum and Bilbo. The pacing works, the acting is amazing, even more amazing and impressive if you realize that that is the first thing they filmed. Martin Freeman came to the set and that was the first day of shooting. And now, once you see it, he deserves an Oscar. Both he and Andy Serkis, I think they deserve an Oscar for that performance. It is the best Gollum that you've seen so far. And not just the computer character, but just the acting is amazing. Fantastic. Anyway, I can't keep talking about it, but there's so much more that I want to talk about. I doubt that I will have time to do this in 1 hour. Anyway, so the story splits up, and then it comes together again. We're still talking about the balance of the movie and the balance of the story. So you get a reunion of the two storylines, which is very well done. The event of the book on which it's based is expanded a little bit, slightly different, but most elements are still there. But it works really well. I think it works perfect in this movie incarnation. And then the end sequence is dramatized, as I mentioned before, but it's done very tastefully, I think. And again, You will be amazed with what they did with that particular sequence, especially if you've read the book just recently and then you see the movie versions. Like, oh, wow. Tolkien would have been proud of this scene. It is really good. And it serves the character development of the characters, which, again, it's not just action because of the action, because you want to end the movie on a high point. It serves the story and serves the characters. And that, to me, is proof of real craftsmanship. That shows that this director, Peter Jackson, is in control of himself and he doesn't get lost in, like, a Michael Bay who's just like, give me more explosions. Peter Jackson, it's all about the story. And so whatever you see, it always serves Bilbo and it serves the story that Tolkien wanted to tell. So I think it's very respectfully done. And the end result is really, really, really good. So when the movie ends, it's not at all like what I expected it to be. It's like, oh, come on, show us the rest of the story. No, I left the theater feeling very satisfied. And I was like, that was a beautiful story arc. I'm so glad with this first part of the story. There was a good ending. It felt natural. And it can keep me busy for the next year, waiting for the second movie. I didn't feel robbed of part of the story because they decided to turn this into three movies. And again, I think that if they would have ended the movie with Lake Town, it would have been a disaster. They would have rushed through the story and we wouldn't have had the same experience, I think. And now I feel that this everything in this pacing of the movie just works and it is what this story needs. So I think they made the right call splitting this up in three movies. And I bet you'll agree with me. Also mentioned that the movie does a terrific job emulating the style of the existing trilogy, so visually, but also the tone of the movie, the direction, it's very similar. Well, it's the same director. But it makes me wonder what would have happened if they had, you know, chosen another director to work on this. I think it really helps that it's Peter Jackson because he knows how to tell this story and he uses the same grammar in a way, the same visual grammar, and that's nice. There's some very nice subtle parallels with some of the scenes we've seen in Lord of the Rings. It's not in a book, but it could have been in a book. But it's great. There's these little moments where it's like, oh, wonderful, wonderful. Star Wars does that all the time. Like these internal references, like a line of someone. And then it's exactly the same line that Han Solo uses in three movies further down the road. There are moments like that in this movie as well. And it's enjoyable. And it ties the two trilogies together in a really nice way. And I think even that if you will watch the entire six movies in chronological order, it will actually add some depth to scenes in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. You're like, oh, that's why that happens, because now we've seen this. So again, so it's pretty similar to some of the qualities of the Star Wars six movies, despite the fact that this movie is a lot better than the prequel, than The Phantom Menace. As I mentioned, old familiar characters are brought back in a very natural way. They look younger. Amazing, amazing. There are some great new characters. One of them is very eccentric. I think you know who I mean. Very much kind of like unexpectedly eccentric. It almost felt to me like this character would have been totally at home in a Harry Potter movie as well. So it's a character, a type of character that we haven't seen in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. It's totally the same type of character that we see in Tolkien's writings. It's not out of character. I think it's really great. It works well. Also, there was much more interaction with Gandalf and the rest of the familiar characters. That role was bigger than I thought it would be, and it's great. It's a great addition to the big character. And again, while watching this, I was like, oh, why did they take out Tom Bombadil in the Lord of the Rings? Now I really miss him. because I was like, this character makes me think of Tom Bombadil, and they could have done something similar for The Lord of the Rings. And it's just one of these iconic characters of Tolkien's world that had, that should have been there. And yeah, who knows? They might put him back in. I think now that I've seen this character, is like, yeah, they could totally pull off Tom Bombadil as well. And it would have worked. The movies would have been a bit too long, probably. Anyway, also, I already talked about this villain that is introduced. Amazing, 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 amazing. Love it. All the acting performances are amazing. They're on par and oftentimes better than what you see in Lord of the Rings. The acting is excellent. I hope that this movie will get a lot of Oscars for the acting, because it deserves it. The language. Oh, we speculated about this. Would we hear dwarven language? What other languages would we hear? Of course, the Lord of the Rings trilogy was famous for the elvish language that was spoken. Well, the languages are back. We even get to hear a little bit more of the dwarven language, which is very cool. Won't tell you much more. It's tiny, but it is dwarven language, so I'll take it. There's a lot of elvish, and the orcs also seem to be a lot more wordy than they used to be, and it seems that their language is much more evolved or developed than it was for the existing trilogy. So great stuff for, after all, Tolkien. He was a language freak. He loved to develop these languages. And it's nice to see that this movie pays homage to that. And they took it seriously. Very believable. I'd love to see a production video on the development of these languages and how they did the coaching of the actors. Because it's pretty difficult to speak those languages. But it works. And it makes, again, it adds to the realism of Middle-earth. Let's talk about the humor. The Hobbit, the book, is a funny book. There's lots. It's very lighthearted. Well, the humor is part of this story, and it works. It all works, and everything that made people laugh in the theater is straight from the book, which I think was the most cool part of it. I was like, this is Tolkien that you're laughing, that makes you laugh. It's not Peter Jackson. It's Tolkien, and that's amazing. Delivery, comedic timing by the actors is so good. To me, was a revelation. It's like, oh, wow, that is how funny the book actually was, and I forgot about it. And then it's just so much fun to hear the entire audience chuckle at the same time and grin throughout the movie. Now, who is the star of the story? Who is the star of the movie? I think it's very balanced. Bilbo is great, but he's also very humble and down to earth. The dwarves are much more exuberant. They're amazing. Gandalf is great. There's a lot more Gandalf in this movie than we have in The Lord of the Rings. And there is also, he's more fleshed out in a way. It's much more the Gandalf of the books. Shows some new sides. The elves are so regal. So to me, they had a great impact on me. I was like, wow. I love these elves. They're great. You know, Elrond is great in this movie. And the villains are so much more. I love the orcs and the whatever is evil and ugly. It is so much better than the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I loved it. Special effects. I got to speed up a little bit because I'm looking at the time and I need to start wrapping up. The special effects. Great leap forward, of course, as you can expect. Beautiful, seamless. Rivendell is breathtaking thanks to the effects. Some of the camera movements are sometimes a bit over the top, a bit too fancy. But, you know, it's just details here. There is this controversial vehicle. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. It works well in close-up. It works better than I thought it would, but it doesn't work at all in the wider scenes. The animation there is jarring. And that surprised me. It looked like a video game. And it's like, is that the 48 frames per second that does this? It wasn't realistic enough. And that was the one point where I was like, ooh, this could have benefited from a little bit more time. Or perhaps shoot it in a different way. But again, it's a detail. Who cares, you know? I'll talk about that in my spoiler-filled review later on with Inge and Dave. The dwarves and the regular sized beings, a lot of that in the original trilogy was done in a practical way. They were all in the same scene. Now it's done with CGI, but it's really well done. There are only a few moments, and that's just because we are so savvy and we know how they film this. There are a few scenes where I was like, okay, Martin Freeman is now probably looking at a tennis ball on a stick. And you know that the other actor is not really there. And you can tell, but you can only tell if you know how this kind of stuff is filmed. I guess 99% of the people, of the audience, won't notice it. Gollum. Oh my gosh. Gollum is stunning. And I loved, and that's all I'm going to say about it, I loved how they closed the visual gap with the first his first appearance in the Fellowship of the Ring. That's before they developed, you know, the whole animated character. And so there it looked as if there was a big gap, kind of like a almost incompatibility between the Gollum that we know from the Two Towers movie and the first glimpse of Gollum that we get. But they did something here, and I'll let you discover it. Where it's like, oh, smart. Now this Gollum actually resembles the Gollum that we've seen in that glimpse from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And it's brilliant. I was like, I didn't expect that. So we're light years away from Jar Jar Binks here. All the digital characters are amazing. And especially because they're all acting. They're real characters. They're three-dimensional characters. And that is, I think, what elevates it to another level. There was another location that we get to see in the movies, all created in CGI, I guess. They might have used some models, I don't know. But it's if you're a fan of the LOTRO game, then you'll know this area, and you'll be so excited to see it. I was blown away. It's like, oh, show me more of that. This is so awesome. Anyway, it's very different from anything we've seen so far in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and I loved that they put it in here. Exhilarating. The color grading of the movie, already mentioned it, it's beyond anything I expected. Lord of the Rings was often very drab and murky in colors and in kind of the shadows, etc. This movie shines, it radiates, it's like a painting, like one of those medieval paintings that I talked about. Beautiful colors, so beautiful. It's like a living painting that you're watching. This movie shines. Makeup and costumes. Makeup is fantastic. It should get an Oscar, I think. I still think that it's mostly makeup that made these old actors look younger. Even the mysterious wizard we know from the Two Towers looks many years younger. Whereas, you know, he's in his 90s and you wouldn't tell. The costumes are fantastic. Everything looks real because it is real. The outfits of the dwarves are amazing. The elves were super impressive. Elrond looks so good in this movie, much better than in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. The orcs and the other dark creatures, much more variety in character than Lord of the Rings. You know, in the Lord of the Rings game, LOTRO, a lot of the orcs are kind of clones. They're generic animations, but you're in for a treat. If that's the only orcs you know, every orc here is different, and there are a lot of great, great character designs there. So they didn't cut corners there. The sound, if you've seen the Foley department at work in the last production video, you must have a huge respect for the sound production of this movie. It worked really well. One detail: the Wilhelm scream is in there. Now, if you don't know what that is, Google it. It is this one sound bit of a yell, a scream, a death scream that is almost in any movie. It's in Star Wars, it's in all the classic movies, and they managed to squeeze it in here. And I'm not going to tell you when that is. You'll have to catch that for yourself. But let me know if you found it. There is, the Wilhelm scream is there. And I was laughing out loud, and everybody around me was like, why is he laughing? Anyway, the music, very similar to the existing music. The Misty Mountain theme, of course, is the main theme of the movie. In my opinion, it was used a little bit too often. The Shire theme returns and is expanded upon. I love that theme. But it felt, overall, the music was, it's great, but I wish for new themes, more innovation there. But it's good, it's good, it works. However, the songs are brilliant. Oh, there was always a big question. The books are full of songs, but that doesn't really work in a movie, right? Well, it does. Howard Shore and Peter Jackson pulled it off. They made it feel very organic and natural. I was very impressed. Even the pop song at the end worked better than I thought it would at the end of the movie. So there's a lot of singing, but it is fantastic. Predictions and spoilers. Okay, did I enjoy the movie after having followed it so closely? Was there anything new and surprising while I've said this time and again? Yes, there was. The entire movie constantly surprised me. And there was a lot to take in. I have to see it several times. The backstory is very detailed. There's just a lot going on, and I need to watch it several times to fully enjoy all those different dimensions of the movie. There are also some interesting, very intriguing moments, and I think they will spur a lot of debate. I can't wait to ask Dave what he thought of a few scenes in a certain place that I was like, whoa, I did not expect him to take this direction. It works for me, but I'm not sure if it will work for everyone, but I liked it. And wow. Anyway, I've already said too much. So did my predictions come true? Well, actually more than I thought. There were a few moments where I was like, yeah, I got that one wrong. But then immediately I was like, well, I'm so glad I got that wrong because, you know, this is so much better. overall, well, you can tell by the tone of my voice that I am very excited about this movie, that I loved the experience. And I can't wait to see it again. Gonna watch it tomorrow with Inge. She's coming over here to do the planning for 2013 of this podcast and many of the other shows that we make over at sqpn.com, and we'll take advantage of her being here to watch the movie again, and then Dave will watch the movie on the 14th when it premieres in the United States, and then we will get together and talk about it in detail, and that review is going to be full of spoilers. And something tells me that 1 hour is not enough. 2 hours is not going to be enough. 3 hours is not going to be enough. 4 hours might just work. So we will undoubtedly keep you entertained for many more shows to come because this movie deserves it. There's just so much going on. And I hope that that you enjoyed this. Now, it might very well be that you're listening to this way after you've seen the movie. I hope that if that's the case and you didn't dare to listen because for fear of being spoiled anyway, even though I promised you no spoilers, that it was still enjoyable and that, well, the things that I have to kind of describe in vague terms, you know, that you know what I was talking about and what I was referring to. So I hope you get some enjoyment out of that as well. And if you're listening to this before you've seen the movie, well, I hope it's not going to be too disappointing, because you can tell I love this movie. I'm super excited about it. So I hope I'm not overselling it and then you come back and it's like, I thought it was going to be so awesome, but Father Roderick was really full of it. You know, it's all overstating this. But something tells me that you're going to enjoy this movie. I did. And it's just one of these movies that the moment I walked out of the theater, I was like, I want to go back. I want to go see the movie. But then again, it was 3:30 in the morning. So I got some sleep first. Anyway, go to sqpn.com for more shows. Also, that's the place where you can find out how you can support us in our mission to make programs like this one. And we are a nonprofit organization, SQPN, that is. So we don't make any money on this. And we actually can make these shows because of the support of our listeners. And, you know, if you've got a dime to spare and you want to help out and you want to support us and encourage us, then you can go to sqpn.com/donate. That's where we have posted the information on how you can contribute to the future of these shows. Because we're full of plans. And, of course, with two more Hobbit movies waiting for us, we want to keep doing this podcast as well, as you can imagine. So thanks in advance for your support. And, you know, even if you can't contribute, there are other ways to help us out. First of all, by sending us feedback. Just send that to tolkien@sqpn.com or use the tab on the sqpn.com website, the SpeakPipe service. And use our affiliate buttons. If you shop at Amazon, just click on that Amazon button. It's a little help, but it's, you know, all the little bits help. And if you want to set up a website or a blog, I recommend Bluehost. And if you click on the Bluehost button, you'll also support SQPN. So many ways in which you can contribute to the future of the show. Thanks for listening.
SQPN, and God bless. Leading the way in Catholic new media.